Government workers miss another paycheck. Democrats get another candidate. And Tom Brady is going to another Super Bowl. Great. We're calling pass interference on the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Kamala Harris makes it official. While we wait on Biden and Beto, what's the Democratic field looking like now?
We've got senators. We've got former House members. We also have a record number of women running. And you've got a Black. You've got a Latino. And a gay man. We're really seeing a lot of the diversity of America in this Democratic field.
Plus, as we approach 2020, will the media learn from their mistakes of 2016?
One of the problems we have with our press corps is that when you have these massive defaults, they aren't followed by inquiry and reflection. I don't think they appreciate how much they simply absorb them as body blows and just go on to the next story.
And we look back at the history of politicians and their growing affinity for late-night talk shows.
Often, late-night television is a younger audience, and it also gives politicians who are somewhat stiff a chance to be somewhat looser. It has a pretty strong shelf life, and that is why people do it.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And Ike to you, and Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 261 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. There are some 800,000 federal workers still without pay, as the government shutdown has already surpassed 33 days. With President Trump calling the shots for the Republicans, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, after staying on the sidelines, agreed to put Trump's proposals up to a vote. It was never expected to pass, but maybe it's a start. And there are also around 800,000 Democrats who have jumped into, or who are considering jumping into, the race for president. The latest? Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who on Wednesday morning announced he's forming a presidential exploratory committee. This is from his announcement video.
The show in Washington right now is exhausted. The corruption, the fighting, the lying, the crisis, it's got to end. The reality is there's no going back, and there's no such thing as again in the real world. We can't look for greatness in the past. Now, I belong to a generation that is stepping forward right now. We're the generation that lived through school shootings, that served in the wars after 9/11, and we're the generation that stands to be the first to make less than our parents unless we do something different.
If elected, he would not only be the youngest president, he's currently 37, or the first openly gay president, he would also, if memory serves, be the first person to go from mayor of South Bend, Indiana, to the White House. A possible fallback is him running for governor of Indiana next year. But look, we have a long way to go. Let's see what happens. Of course, I wasn't serious about 800,000 Democrats running for president, but the field is getting crowded, and it's only January of 2019. That will be the focus of this week's show: the candidates, the strategies, and how the media cover them. When Kamala Harris got into the race on Monday, she became the third female senator to announce her White House intentions this cycle, following Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand, with the possibility of another, Amy Klobuchar, still to come. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the first female senator to launch a presidential bid? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
She's a lady, and I chanced to meet her in my scuffling days. She's a lady, hypnotized me there that day. I came to play in my usual way. Hey, floating along with the whimsical twinkling in her strange green eyes. linger with me? She said yes, and all the time did fly.
Kamala Harris jumped into the presidential race on Monday, joining an increasingly crowded field that now includes three U.S. senators, one member of the House, a former member of the House, a mayor, a former cabinet official, even an unsuccessful candidate for Congress from West Virginia. And the expectation is that there are many more to come. Addressing the media shortly after her announcement on Good Morning America, Harris described her vision.
I love my country. I love my country. And I feel a sense of responsibility to stand up and fight for the best of who we are. And I'm prepared to fight, and I know how to fight. And in particular, when we're talking about fighting for the values that we hold sacred and dear, when it comes to talking about how we fight for the American people and have leadership in this country that is focused on the needs of the people instead of self-interest, I'm prepared to fight that way. And I believe it will be a winning fight.
Harris has a lot of factors in her favor. She's a strong fundraiser. She could run well in the early South Carolina primary, where black women cast 37% of the primary vote in 2016. And March 3rd is the California primary and its horde of delegates. But she's also been under fire from the left for her record on crime prevention measures when she was district attorney in San Francisco and then state attorney general, the job she held before she came to the Senate 2 years ago. In fact, the entire Democratic field has its pluses and minuses. That's why we have Janet Hook here to keep score. Janet recently returned to the Los Angeles Times as a political reporter after spending 8 years covering politics and Congress for the Wall Street Journal. Janet, whoever you work for, it's always a pleasure having you on the Political Junkie.
Oh, thanks so much, Ken. It's good to be talking to you.
Well, eight candidates are in, with certainly more to come, and it's only January. Is it unusual to have so many presidential hopefuls in the race this early?
Well, you know, it's not unusual for it to start this early. This is a real bumper crop. I actually looked it up, and for Democrats, the record number of candidates running for the presidency came in 1976. So it looks like we're on track for that record to be broken. We don't know. I mean, a lot of people are talking about it or thinking about it. We don't know exactly how many are going to actually pull the trigger and jump in. But, you know, at this pace, there's probably definitely going to be as many as there were in 76, which were 13, I think. And, you know, you talked about the variation of, you know, we've got senators, we've got former House members. We also have this field in the very early stages, they've produced the most incredibly diverse field, just in terms of, you know, you've got a record number of women running. You know, when Hillary Clinton ran, she was the only woman, and we've already got three, four already in the running. So, and you've got a black, you've got a Latino, and a gay man. I mean, we're really seeing a lot of the diversity of America in this Democratic field in a way that we haven't before.
Do you think the size of the field is because the feeling that Donald Trump is vulnerable for 2020, or is there something else going on?
Well, it's a couple of things. First of all, there's just a huge passion in the Democratic Party to beat Trump. And there is no obvious front runner, so that the field is like about as wide open as it's ever been or been in recent years. Well, I suppose if Biden gets in, you know, he would be kind of the establishment favorite as a former vice president. But even if Biden gets in, it's just not clear that he is the man for the era that he will. So there's basically, it's a field with no front runner, even among the people who are thinking about it, let alone the ones who get in. The other thing is that Donald Trump, having won when everybody thought he was such a long shot, I think a lot of people are looking in the mirror and saying, well, geez, if Donald Trump can run and win, why not me? The other thing is, I think Democrats are just feeling filled with enthusiasm and optimism because of the big victories in the 2018 midterms. There's a lot of reasons to think about running. Now, when you actually get down to the brass tacks of actually running and seeing who else is in the field and how much money it's going to take for each one of them, like I said, not everyone who's thinking about it is going to actually take the plunge.
You know, when you were saying that they look in the mirror and see, well, if Trump could do it, why can't I? I was smiling because, you know, that long-running joke that when members of the Senate look into a mirror, they see the next president of the United States. And we already have three senators in the race. We have Harris, Gillibrand, and Warren. with the possibility of more. Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar. I've even seen mention of Colorado's Michael Bennett and Oregon's Jeff Merkley. That's a lot of senators.
Yeah, it is a lot of senators. So, you know, it is a hothouse for ambition. It's not clear that it's the best incubator for presidential ambition. We'll see. I think in this case, though, I think we're seeing, like, in many ways, a lot of the things that have made senators not such strong candidates has kind of been balanced out by two things. First of all, the way campaigns are driven by social media and fundraising. I think senators are in a really strong position to do that now. In the era of Donald Trump, they also have a more of a platform to kind of put themselves in opposition to Trump compared to, say, governors, who are, like, traditionally seen as the stronger kinds of presidential candidates because they have executive experience.
Like we saw during the Kavanaugh hearings, you saw prospective presidents grilling Brett Kavanaugh.
Right. They got a lot of airtime for that. I can't tell you how many people, when I've talked to voters, you know, even at this very early stage, most of these people are not very well known. When they say, oh, I really like Kamala Harris, I say, well, what do you like about her? And really all they know is, well, she did a really good job of questioning Kavanaugh. That's not a lot, but, you know, people really were paying so much attention to that hearing that that was a pretty good launching pad for visibility, even if it doesn't define what kind of a campaign they'd run.
You know, you were talking earlier about you looked up, you know, the number, the size of the field. I also looked up the number of senators who have run in the past, and political junkies may like this. Maybe nobody else will, but they junkies might. But in 72, you had McGovern and Humphrey and Muskie and Scoop Jackson and Vance Hartke. In 76, you had Jackson and Birchbough and Frank Church and Robert Byrd and Lloyd Benson. And in 84, you had Gary Hart and John Glenn and Alan Cranston and Fritz Holling. So we've had senators run in the past, but again, as you pointed out, this seems different, though, I guess because of color and gender.
Well, and also, I mean, just look at the particular individuals involved. I mean, Bernie Sanders, yes, he's a senator, really, but that's almost incidental to his profile as a presidential candidate. He ran a very strong primary race against Hillary Clinton last time around. Elizabeth Warren isn't just a senator. She's become a national figure, kind of the progressive wing of the party. Kamala Harris and Gillibrand really are running based on their, you know, as far as their national profile is, what they've done in the Senate. And you're right that race and gender has a part in it, in that I do think that the Democratic primary electorate is going to want to see some diversity in their ticket. And you see more diversity. I mean, it's hard to believe this. The Senate isn't a particularly diverse institution, but you see more diversity among senators than you do, say, among the nation's governors.
Well, let's start a little bit with the senators who are already in, or the candidates who are already in. Kamala Harris's announcement on Monday got a lot of attention. What does she bring to the table?
You know, she is a woman. She's Black. She has a record that is both her strength and her weakness. As you commented, her record as a prosecutor back in California has drawn some criticism from the left for kind of the tough-on-crime profile. But that's also an asset if you're looking for a candidate who can kind of reach a broader base and kind of appeal to people for whom law and order is a concern, like, I don't know, suburban women. So she's not inexperienced. She may only have 2 years in the Senate, but that she does have a lot of experience at both at the local and the state, as well as the federal level.
Kirsten Gillibrand has also been under heavy scrutiny, heavy criticism for, I guess, a perceived move to the left. When she was representing upstate New York congressional district, you know, she was touting her A rating from the NRA. She talked about securing the border. It was a conservative district, but she was no liberal darling, shall we say.
Yeah. No, she definitely has a record that has shifted to the left from when she went from the House to the Senate. It points to one thing, like almost all of these candidates have something to explain in their background. You know, in Kamala Harris's case, it's she's had to answer some questions about her record as a prosecutor that she said, well, you know, I didn't really agree with that. And in Gillibrand's case, it was pretty straightforwardly a political change. You know, her constituency became much wider and more liberal when she was representing all of New York State. But on those issues, a lot of Democratic primary voters like to think of people as having their positions on guns and immigration be on principle and not just representing the voters that that have elected them.
Although what I think may be your toughest problem is the fact that, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of Democrats who will never forgive her what she said about Al Franken, you know, calling on him to resign in the wake of the sexual harassment charges that were made against him. I'm going to play a little piece of tape here. Joy Behar of The View was among those liberals who were very unhappy with Gillibrand's role in that matter. This was on her show last year. And Gillibrand, of course, if you listen to Gillibrand, she's not backing down at all.
He's entitled to a hearing, that he is, but he's not entitled to my silence, Joy. And
no,
when you have eight allegations, eight credible allegations, multiple women, I have a 14-year-old son, I have a 9-year-old son. How am I supposed to tell him it's okay to grab a woman here, it's okay to grab a woman here, but it's not okay to grab a woman here? Absolutely not. I'm not going to have that conversation. That is the wrong conversation to be having. Conversation, obviously what was alleged against Al Franken is very different
yes.
than what's alleged about Steve Wynn than what's alleged about President Trump.
Right.
Very different. I understand that what's alleged against Roy Moore. All different. Different gradations.
But you're giving it an unequal equivalency.
No, you're not. Because it's not okay, Joy. It is not okay to grab women without their consent.
Okay.
It's not okay. So why would you want to hold our elected leaders to the lowest standard and not the highest standard? We should be holding all our elected leaders to the higher standard. And I can't be a good mother, and I can't be a good senator if I am silenced just because it's my friend.
Janet, what do you think of that? I mean, she's taking a pounding on social media, and between what she said about Franken and what she said about Bill Clinton, right, that he should have resigned, you know, I hear lots of "I will never vote for her" kind of comments.
Right. This is another example of a candidate whose strength might also be her greatest liability, which is that she is kind of defining herself as a candidate with special standing because she's a woman, a mother of two young kids, and, you know, kind of bragging on her record of advancing legislation to advance women's rights, protecting women against sexual abuse in the military. But this episode kind of with Al Franken came up in the peak of the frenzy around the Me Too movement. You have to remember this was around the same time that Republicans were having to defend Roy Moore, the candidate in Alabama who was running in a special election who faced allegations of having, you know, abused and assaulted young women in his past. There was ongoing fury about the Republicans' unwillingness to criticize President Trump for his sexual misconduct. And so there was a sense at the time of, okay, so now it's one of ours. What do we do? And she was among the first, I think she was the first, to call for Senator Franken to resign. And it was just a very difficult debate. And a lot of people thought there was kind of a rush to judgment when he did resign. And, you know, it remains to be seen how much that sticks in the craw of the average voter. I mean, I do think that there are donors and activists for whom that really has permanently affected their view of her. I mean, the problem was they thought it was not only unjust, but that it was her being really opportunistic, that it was kind of her way of elevating her visibility and stature on the national stage by taking that leadership role. So I don't know how far-reaching the fallout from that will be. It is a factor for some people.
And there are questions about Bernie Sanders, too, about sexual harassment charges leveled against his campaign from 2016. Is this a momentary blip, or is this more serious than that?
Well, I mean, it was serious enough that Senator Sanders met with some of the women who were raising the issue. And he's saying that his 2020 campaign, if there is one, and there probably will be one, will be more respectful, have more, you know, procedures in place for handling it. I mean, their response is, it's not an excuse, but part of his explanation is, well, you know, this was kind of a real shoestring campaign that kind of grew out of nothing, and I didn't really know what was going on. I mean, that kind of thing just doesn't really cut it, and he'll be under a tremendous amount of scrutiny on that front if he does run.
Let me just end with these two questions, and they may be the biggest questions. Does Joe Biden run, and what does Beto O'Rourke do?
Yes, two of the three Bs. I figure, you know, Biden, Beto, and Bernie are the three candidates outstanding that could have the biggest impact on the rest of the field. And Biden has been doing a kind of private debate with himself and his family and his inner circle about whether or not he's going to run. I think he believes, and his supporters believe, that he, of all candidates, can afford to wait, that he doesn't need an early entry to establish his visibility or his fundraising base.
Although the first debates are coming up this June, so he doesn't have that long to wait.
Right, right. And Beto also, you know, Beto O'Rourke was kind of catapulted to prominence by his Senate campaign against Ted Cruz in 2018. And, you know, nobody really knows whether he's going to go ahead and do it. And if he does, you know, he does have this kind of fundraising prowess that blew everybody away. The bloom has come a little bit off the rose recently because he's been, I don't know, blogging from the road, and some people think it's kind of self-indulgent, and I don't know. It'll certainly be entertaining if he gets in.
Didn't we see something about him cleaning his teeth or something on Instagram?
Yeah, he went to the dentist and live-streamed it, and yeah, no, he's definitely doing a lot of cinema verite for his followers.
Maybe he'll just take a leave of abscess, right? Yeah. Okay, sorry about
that.
Yeah, sorry. If nothing else, it's exciting, and it could keep a political reporter with the Los Angeles Times pretty busy these next 2 years.
Yep. And it'll keep the political junkie busy, too.
For better or worse, right?
All right.
Anyway, you can find a lot of tidbits from Janet Hook's Twitter feed. Check her out at HookJan. Janet, you are the best. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ken.
Some good news to report. There's a frontrunner for the Democratic presidential nomination, and it's Kamala Harris, the senator from California. At least so says John Fund of Fox News, because Harris is a woman and a person of color, and she hails from California. Another conservative, Guy Benson of townhall.com, has a new column with the headline, "Forget the Early Polls. Is this the Democrats' frontrunner?" with a picture of Harris. But it's not just the right wing that feels this way. Rolling Stone magazine also ranks Harris as number one. With California moving its primary up to Super Tuesday on March 3rd, Rolling Stone breathlessly wrote, she could bank a delegate lead that proves difficult to overcome. A week after the 2018 election, without even waiting for candidates to announce, Chris Stolizza and Harry Enten of CNN wrote a column entitled, "Why Kamala Harris is the New Democratic Frontrunner." What a shame President Ed Muskie isn't around to hear any of this. I know it's fun to make lists of presidential candidates, even if Iowa is 13 months away. I know it brings clicks. But it's long saddened me how we in the media need to anoint frontrunners well before the first voter had her say. The need to focus on horse race coverage, who's up, who's down, is pointless this far out. Wouldn't we rather know where they stand, examine their records? I keep hoping that every election cycle will be different, but it never is. One person I suspect shares my frustration is Jay Rosen. He's a journalism professor at NYU and a leading media critic. Jay, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you very much, and hello to all the junkies.
Well, if memory serves, and believe me, I'm trying to forget, but when I think of 2016, I think of how the media were having so much fun, such excitement with Donald Trump's candidacy. CNN almost couldn't contain itself promoting its sponsorship of one of the debates.
Round two of the GOP presidential debate.
I think we're led by stupid people.
Trump doesn't have a proven conservative record.
September 16th on CNN. This night will not go quietly. The Republican presidential debates at 6 and 9 p.m. only on CNN.
I mean, they went into the debate as if it was a heavyweight championship fight.
Let's get ready to rumble!
To me, that was the absolute essence of the 2016 campaign and the coverage of it. It was anointing frontrunners. It was setting up debates like they were championship fights.
Well, I think the problem with horse race coverage, which has been observed over many, many years now, is that it isn't really pitched to the voter as voter. Should I vote for the front runner? Does that make sense? Should I bring into the voting booth the list of candidates who have the best chance of winning? And part of the strangeness of this very familiar model is it doesn't actually ask us to participate in the election as citizens. It asks us to participate as spectators and audience to be entertained, sort of the crowd at professional wrestling. And that's how this form, this genre, positions us as the audience. And it's what political journalists think they should be doing every 4 years, because if they didn't think they should be doing it, it wouldn't repeat itself as it does.
You tweeted this the other day. Let me quote you here. It says, "It's become clearer and clearer to me that without intervention, coverage of the 2020 campaign is likely to be a disaster for everyone except Trump and his core voters who want to watch it all burn anyway." What have you been seeing that leads you to this kind of assessment?
Well, there's two things. One was after Elizabeth Warren's announcement, which in a way kicked off the campaign, even though there had been other candidates before her. And the reaction to that announcement was it was clear that all of the old reflexes were being brought out, and it really wasn't anything different in the tone of it. That was one thing. The other thing was a little bit more intricate. During the 2 years of Donald Trump as president, with the extraordinary attacks on the news media as enemy of the people, the unbelievable record of falsehood and misstatement from the president himself, the breakdown of institutions like White House reporting itself and the briefing, and the kind of hostility that the president is deliberately trying to whip up against journalists, the press often found itself positioned as Trump's opponent, adversary, regardless of whether they wanted to be or thought of themselves that way. And with the takeover of the House by the Democratic Party, and with the primary coming up in the Democratic Party for the next election, you had the return of these normal conditions in which journalists could show that they are between opponents, that they stand between the Democrats and Trump and the Republicans, that they are of neither party, and that they don't have this opposition role. And I think that the return of that very familiar structure is so attractive to them, and the election provides a perfect opportunity for that. So that's why I said, well, this is going to work for everybody except Trump's voters.
Well, you mentioned two things there, and I want to explore it a little more. First of all, the thing about Trump, I remember during the 2016 campaign, there would be some accusation that, well, either the Access Hollywood tape or something about tearing down Democratic institutions. And then journalists would say, yeah, but what about Hillary's emails? And basically, it was the false equivalence that reporters do because that's the way they were trained. But there seemed to be something terribly hollow with that approach.
Yeah. Well, during the 2016 campaign, where I wrote a lot about the press and the coverage of it while it was happening, you have to remember, and anybody who has been part of political journalism would recall this, that again and again, Trump did things or said things that caused the experienced reporters in the press corps to say, well, that's it. His candidacy is over. One that particularly sticks out was when he ridiculed John McCain. But there were, in fact, if you went back and you actually tried to count the episodes like that, there were hundreds of them, of things that he said that would have killed the candidacy of a Mitt Romney or Rick Santorum or, you know, a conventional candidate. Not only was that interesting in itself, but it tells you that the 2016 campaign was a complete collapse of conventional wisdom about presidential politics as borne by political editors and reporters. Like, their knowledge of what was likely or their knowledge of what was possible, probable, was completely faulty. And one of the problems we have with our press corps is that when we have these massive collapses of responsibility, as we had in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003, as we had with the failure to alert the country to the financial crisis in 2008, and as we had in the 2016 election, you have these massive defaults. They aren't followed by inquiry and reflection. The profession has no way of studying itself. Nobody asks in any systematic or sustained way, what was wrong with our approach here? How can we change it? And even though in their minds they're relentlessly self-critical and they know about these failures, I don't think they appreciate how much they simply absorb them as body blows and just go on to the next story. And that's certainly what happened after 2016.
You know, you mentioned the hundreds of things that Trump said. And as you were saying that, I was thinking how Rick Perry's presidential candidacy collapsed.
On one.
Because he couldn't remember the third cabinet.
One remark.
Exactly.
Exactly. It's amazing. Like my favorite one is, I don't know if you remember this, but after Trump clinched the nomination, he was trying to persuade John Kasich to run with him. And somebody from Trump's camp got in touch with Kasich's offices and said, we want John Kasich to consider being the running mate. And he will be given responsibility for domestic policy and foreign policy. And Kasich says, well, what's the president going to do? And the answer was, make America great again, right? So here you have a story in which the candidate who won the nomination is essentially saying he has no intention of doing the job, right? That would have killed the candidacy of anybody else, but it didn't. So that kind of failure requires reflection, but we don't see that reflection. And this is part of the reason why every 4 years the campaign journalists say, we're going to do it differently this time, and it never happens.
Well, you also mentioned the coverage of Elizabeth Warren's candidacy late last year. And two things. First of all, the word likability kept coming out in articles about her, like
is she likable enough? Yeah.
Ted Cruz was Mr. Likability, right? I mean,
yeah, right.
But that's what they kept talking about, and then they focused on the fact that she, I mean, clumsily or not, she opened up a can of beer on her video and offered her husband some beer, and everybody said, and they focused more on the beer than anything she had to say about Wall Street or anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, part of the reason that this pattern continues, and I think this is important for your listeners to understand, is that as easy as it is to bash and criticize horse race coverage for campaigns, we have to recognize that it has a lot of strengths, too. And these are the reasons that I think we continue to see it. Strengths in the sense that it solves problems. So an example would be the simple fact that it is very repeatable. You can just bring it out every 4 years, sort of like the Christmas decorations that are in the attic. You know, they work every year, and you plug them in, and they operate pretty much as they did before. So the horse race is like that. It's repeatable. Not only is it repeatable, but it's a consensus model. Everyone can get behind it. And so it's easy to coordinate effort in large organizations like NBC News, which is a sprawling organization. If everyone understands the horse race model, you don't need to instruct them. It also allows journalists to position themselves as above the fray and as detached from politics, because the question of who's going to win and related questions like, is this a smart strategy, seem very unideological, and that is part of the appeal of those things. It's also a way to generate audience interest, because it's like a sport or a wrestling match or a race, right? And a race, the idea of a race, who's going to win, has built-in suspense, and it has a sort of a built-in storyline. So there's that. And then, because almost everybody who starts out to run for president, which is right now, 20-something candidates, all but one is a loser in the end. And so there's all kinds of bad news to portray and mistakes to point out, like the episode with the beer and Elizabeth Warren. So there's sort of like an endless number of ways that the journalist can feel and I'm sort of superior in sitting in judgment upon these loser candidates. And then you put all these things together, and it's hard to beat the horse race model, even though its weaknesses are very glaring and quite apparent.
Let me focus on your who's going to win comment, because there somehow seems to be a need for reporters to make predictions. I mean, of course, you know, the primaries and caucuses are more than a year away, and I always argue that if we couldn't predict who was going to win in 2016 on the day of the election, where do we have any business predicting what's going to happen a year or even months away? And yet we keep doing it. You turn on the TV and they're saying, well, I think he or she is going to win because X, Y, or Z. What's the point? Why?
Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, if one of the reasons 2016 was such a debacle for the campaign press, and it was a debacle, a disaster, is not just that they didn't tell us what Trump's real chances were and they misportrayed the election, but they invest so much in their ability to call the election, right? And when you have the horse race as your template for election coverage and you can't get that right, then it's like your entire performance feels like a failure. And that was certainly the case in 2016.
Let me talk a little bit about the Trump's crusade to diminish and tear down the press. Well, first of all, how serious is it to fundamental democratic institutions?
I think it's extremely serious. I mean, when political scientists ask themselves, is this country a democracy? They look at about four or five things that tell you whether there actually is a living democracy in that country. One of them is free and fair elections. Another is an independent judiciary. A third is the rule of law. And the fourth is a free press. And there's a reason for that, because the entire system can't work without that. And so for the strongest, loudest voice in the culture to be continually describing the free press as not only faulty or biased or against him, which have been longstanding complaints from candidates and presidents, especially Republicans, but going beyond that, to portray the press as an enemy, as undermining democracy, is extraordinary. There's nothing in American history like it. And it also shows that the president doesn't really understand what it takes to have a healthy democracy, which is why he can also undermine elections and say they're rigged and undermine the intelligence community and say that it's biased against me and attack judges without thinking about what he's doing and portray the FBI as a corrupt agency. He just doesn't care. And this is one of the things that he doesn't care about.
And that leads to this question, which we know. I mean, what happens when the public's trust in the media is so diminished that when or if Robert Mueller comes up with a completely damning report, or even if Trump were to lose his reelection bid, and you get a large percentage of the American people who refuse to accept it or even acknowledge it because they just don't believe it? That's one of the fears I have.
Definitely. I think this is the one strategy, if you can call it that. I don't think it really is a strategy. I think it's more of an artifact, but it appears in some ways to be a strategy that you can discern in Trump's behavior about the press, which is he's trying to discredit reports that will eventually come out from the Mueller inquiry before they happen. And if you mistrust what everything CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal says, then you have bought Trump some immunity, in effect, from those findings. That's the only strategy that you can see. And I don't know if it's really a conscious strategy. It may just be his raging narcissism and a kind of unintentional effect of that. But what it means is that for about one-third or 30% of the electorate, the major source of information for them about Trump is Trump. And that is an authoritarian news system. So for one-third of the public, we have an authoritarian news system that's already up and running. Or another way to put it is, before your Washington Post reporter gets to work and logs on in the morning, one-third of his or her potential public is already gone, and there's nothing that he or she can do to engage that portion.
You've been watching this stuff for a long, long time. Is there... I just cautioned against people making predictions, but is there any chance things can turn out okay?
Well, I think there's a chance that the next president will find political gain in returning to a more traditional model of the presidency. I think that's possible. The other possibility is that they will learn, either a Democratic or a Republican president, from what Trump did and modify it so that it's rougher edges or it's more absurd or extreme features kind of go away, but the core of it remains. I feel, for example, that there's no chance that the next president won't use Twitter to go around journalists and to kind of like conduct his own media show. I think that's going to become a permanent part of our politics because Trump showed how effective it can be. But that's one possibility. And I think there is generational change in journalism. It's just taking a long time, like decades rather than a year or two. And this particular area that we're talking about in your show, Ken, which is campaign coverage, seems to be spectacularly immune to change. I'm not totally sure why that is, but it's certainly a striking result.
Jay Rosen teaches journalism at New York University and writes a media blog at pressthink.org. Jay, thanks so much for a very important and very depressing conversation.
You are so welcome.
There's something strange going on tonight. There's something going on that's not quite right. Michael's nervous and the lights are bright.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the first person to announce a serious presidential candidacy on a TV program? This answer is not going to satisfy everyone. This person didn't actually declare his candidacy, and yes, there were conditions he added to him running. But I'm going with Ross Perot, who kinda sorta announced on CNN's Larry King Live on February 20th, 1992.
Is there any scenario in which you would run for president? Can you give me a scenario in which you'd say, okay, I'm in?
Well, number one, I don't want to.
I know, but is there a scenario?
Number two, you know, if you're that serious, you, the people, are that serious, you register me in 50 states. And if you're not willing to organize and do that, then this is all just talk.
Wait, Larry. Are you
saying... I'm saying to the ordinary folks, if you're dead serious...
I want to see some sweat.
It is now considered campaign lore that Perot announced his candidacy on that show. Don't yell at me. Anyway, the randomly selected winner is Doug Marshall of Lincoln, Nebraska. Doug wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the political junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. Ross Perot's decision to talk about running for president on a TV show was unprecedented. It's also led others to do the same thing. This year alone, and we're still in January, Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard announced on Van Jones' CNN program,
"I have decided to run and will be making a formal announcement within the next week."
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert,
"I'm filing an exploratory committee for President of the United States tonight."
And just this Monday, California Senator Kamala Harris on Good Morning America,
"I am running for President of the United States."
Well, and
and I'm very excited about it.
To be sure, we've come a long way since the days when a presidential candidacy announcement was a solemn moment, not accompanied by late-night jokes or audience applause, such as what Robert Kennedy did when he declared in the caucus room of the old Senate office building in March of 1968.
"I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. I do not run for the presidency merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies."
Is this new trend good for democracy? Good for the process? Jane Hall is a professor in journalism in the School of Communication at American University in Washington and a longtime media analyst. Professor Hall, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, I assume the reason why candidates are doing this is because they think it works. Does it?
Well, it works in a number of ways. And when I hear the Kennedy announcement, I do think, oh my goodness, we've come a distance, and is it good for democracy? But I think that there are many good things about it. And the reason why they do it is because it gives them an audience. And often late night television is a younger audience, is presumed to be a younger audience. And it also gives politicians who are somewhat stiff a chance to be somewhat looser. And so, you know, their media advisors pick this very carefully. I noticed with Kamala Harris that George Stephanopoulos and Robin Roberts did a very solid, in my view, interview with her and brought up some things such as her record as a law enforcement official that some people had been critical of. When I watched Kirsten Gillibrand, it seemed to me that she was nervous. And there was some interesting language there that I'm sure will be body language, where she reached her hand out and Colbert grabbed her hand. And these things are going to get analyzed over and over, particularly as more women are running. But there are stories in the New York Times and everywhere the next day. There's all kind of online videos. So it has a pretty strong shelf life, and that is why people do it.
You know, you were talking about it makes them feel, it makes the candidates more human, more relaxed. And I think back to the early days when basically it was all but unheard of for a politician to go on a late night talk show. So there was this, I want to play a little piece of tape here, which I love. There was this time in 1963 when Richard Nixon, not long after his defeat for governor of California, and we presumed that he was finished with politics, he went on the Jack Parr show.
"You asked a moment ago whether I had any future political plans to run for anything. And if last November didn't finish it, this will, because believe me, the Republicans don't want another piano player in the White House."
That last line was a shot at the piano playing Harry Truman, but Nixon goes on to play the piano. Boy, that sure loosened up Richard Nixon, didn't it?
Well, you know, Ken, it's interesting for you to play that, because I was remembering also that, you know, he went on that the great, at the time, highly popular show and did Sock It to Me, you know, Laugh-In, which was a series of sketches.
Sock It to Me?
So when Richard Nixon did that, again, you know, there you have a man who was very uncomfortable in any sort of spontaneous media situation pretty much his whole life. You know, he was advised after the presidential debates by Roger Ailes, who was not a natural on television in any way. And so, you know, I think a lot of people at the time thought it was odd, but clearly he and his media advisors thought it was a good thing to do.
Well, two things about Nixon. Before we leave Richard Nixon, and I never like leaving Richard Nixon, but two things I want to focus on here because it fascinates me. When he played the piano, it was so controversial. I was reading some clips, and they said it was below the dignity of a politician. I guess back then politicians had some kind of dignity, I assume. But that's what they said about Nixon. And then, I mean, I remember watching Nixon in '68 when he did "Sock It to Me," and I mean, I almost fell out of my chair. I thought it was a great move. I mean, making Richard Nixon out to be fun, which few people thought was possible. I just thought it was remarkable, and it showed me. Look, I don't know, you know, whatever you think about Nixon at that moment in March of '68, this kid watching it in the Bronx, falling out of his chair, saying, "Wow, that's pretty special."
That's so interesting. Well, I guess we're revealing that we were kids in 1968, but I remember watching it and thinking, frankly, just the opposite. I was like, it made me cringe. It's like, you know, running into your parents at the mall, you know, it was like, ooh, that was my reaction as a kid. So, you know, it obviously cut a lot of different ways at the time.
Oh, I love it. Well, of course, everybody remembers this.
Wow, that 1992 Bill Clinton playing the sax on Arsenio Hall. You know, as I think about it, I think 1992 was probably the year everything changed. Bill Clinton, Ross Perot on Larry King, Bill Clinton being asked by MTV News, you know, in a town hall whether he wore boxers or briefs and answering. There was a huge shift that obviously people who don't know politics from those years don't know, that it was a big, big deal that all these people went on Larry King.
What I love was the reaction. Barbara Walters, when she watched Clinton on Arsenio, she said it was undignified. And George Will said it coarsened the political process. Wow, right?
Mm. You know, I think in the context of today and even back then, I personally don't think that's undignified. You know, I think, again, it seems to me that everything changed in that 1992 election. You had a younger man in Bill Clinton running. You had Ross Perot announcing on Larry King when Larry King was very strong. And today, you know, more recently, you had Michelle Obama doing carpool karaoke. I think that there are degrees of things that can seem undignified. I personally was uncomfortable watching President Obama on the show Between Two Ferns.
What should we do about North IKEA?
While we move on.
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously? What's it like for this to be the last time you ever talked to a president?
It must kind of stink, though, that you can't run, you know, three times.
Actually, I think it's a good idea. If I ran a third time, it'd be sort of like doing a third Hangover movie. Didn't really work out very well, did it?
But you know something, in that case, I know that, you know, Obama wanted to be fun and everything, but it seems like they both lost. I think both Obama and Zach Galifianakis I thought was painful to watch.
I thought it was very painful to watch, and it's not that he shouldn't go and do a show. I mean, his whole appeal, you know, and the reason he said he did it was that that show reaches young people. So somebody, either he saw that show or somebody said, you need to go on this show and talk about things that you want to reach out to young people over. But just as pure television, it was uncomfortable. I thought it was kind of this postmodern, ironic something or other that was going on. You know, he started off by asking him about pardoning the turkey and, of course, the question about being the last black president. I mean, I think there's a fine line there. And I thought that Obama wasn't quite sure what he was doing. I mean, he was a master at this. Normally, you know, very cool, very, very, you know, kind of cool in the media cool way and normally, and was very successful most of the time. But I'm agreeing with you. I thought it was really uncomfortable.
Let me go backwards a little bit. I mean, George Bush Back in 2000, George W. Bush was hoping to succeed Bill Clinton. And there here he is reading the top 10 list on the David Letterman show.
Number two, give Oval Office one heck of a scrubbing.
That was obviously a jab at Bill Clinton and a little cringeworthy as well. But remember, Bush was the kind of guy, the aw shucks candidate you wanted to have beer with. And being on David Letterman's show had to be cool, right?
Well, I think it was. And, you know, after he was in his presidency, people were very critical of his handling of the Iraq War and many other things. So it would not have been such friendly territory. But he had a lot of appeal, you know. I mean, I've always thought it was interesting as a person from Texas that, you know, his cutting brush and his whole way of speaking, and he had a lot of appeal as he was running as a candidate. And I think Letterman, you know, gave him a very strong platform to make his case that he was the kind of guy you'd want to have a beer with. I mean, we are very conflicted in this country. I think one of the points about the bigger picture about all of these appearances and the correspondence dinner and all of that is that Americans kind of want a father figure for president or a mother figure for president. When we get there, they want someone they could have a beer with. They want someone who could be the consoler in chief. I mean, there are a lot of requirements of this. And I think that the idea of mixing it up with somebody and showing that you are maybe not an elite, you know, I mean, there's probably, we could psychoanalyze why this is appealing to people. It's certainly appealing to the candidates and to the hosts because they get a bump up in their ratings, and, you know, it's a trade-off. I mean, like many other media kinds of interviews.
Here's the instance where I think it was the late-night host who suffered. You were talking earlier about, the fact that we've gotten more partisan and more divided in more recent years, and I think this is a perfect example. This is September of 2016 when Fallon had candidate Donald Trump on the show.
Donald, I want to ask you, because the next time I see you, you could be the president of the United States. I just wanted to know if there's something we could do that's just not presidential, really, or something that we can do now that we're just both civilians. Like,
like what? This is... I'm not liking the sound of this. Go ahead.
Could I mess your hair up?
I think that was the end for me, for Jimmy Fallon, because I think by 2016, I don't think the audience was in any mood for a disliked candidate to be humanized. And I assume that's what Fallon was trying to do.
Right, right. Well, that was a moment where Fallon got a great deal of criticism for being beyond obsequious, that it was really inappropriate and that there were far stronger and more important things to ask. I mean, one of the interesting things about this, there's so many interesting aspects to this, Ken. Stephen Colbert did probably one of the best interviews I have ever seen with Joe Biden about the death of his son. You know, so you have that, and then you have Jimmy Fallon, an unfortunate comparison for him, mussing up Trump's hair.
Jane, what do you think the message is in all of this? I mean, clearly people no longer get their political news from what used to be the reliable sources, the news programs and the newspapers. So what are we learning?
Well, I think the first lesson, the biggest lesson, is that you can't succeed. You probably can't lead very well, and you probably can't get elected without being someone who is relatable in some way and communicates reasonably well on television. I think people go on things specifically to reach an audience. Obama goes on The View to reach women, you know, so it's a calculation, but it's also a requirement, I guess, of running for office and being president or any other prominent political person.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the final message is that candidates can't afford to ignore this.
Absolutely. I think not.
Jane Hall is a media analyst and a journalism professor in the School of Communication at American University in Washington. Jane, I love this conversation.
Well, thank you. I loved it, too.
Jane, thank you so much.
Okay.
Everybody's a dreamer, and Everybody's a star, and everybody's in showbiz. It doesn't matter who you are. And those who are successful, be always on your guard. Success walks hand in hand with failure along Hollywood Boulevard.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
People who worked and suffered and struggled for